Club Show. I'm Robin Daly, the chairman and the founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity, and your host for the show. My aim in the show is to talk to the broadest range of practitioners and scientists involved in helping those with cancer to find out more of where the frontiers of integrative medicine are leading us, what are the most exciting developments with the greatest potential to help, and what the latest thinking is on the causes and the mechanisms of cancer. I also talk to expert patients who have often recovered following a terminal diagnosis, and in doing so have become a living research project, potentially with lessons for us all. For this week's show, I've come into central London, where an exciting event is combining talks by survivor extraordinaire Sophie Savage, author of the best-selling book The Cancer Whisperer, which is part autobiography and part resource for meeting and learning from the psychological and the emotional challenges of cancer, and Dr. Francisco Contreras, medical director of the renowned Oasis of Hope Hospital in Mexico, who is currently in the UK for a speaking tour. I'm taking the opportunity to speak to Dr. Contreras on the subject of cancer as a metabolic disease. The Oasis has been approaching cancer as a metabolic disease for more than half a century, and so there's an enormous catalogue of experience for Dr. Contreras to draw on. My reason for choosing this subject is that Yes to Life's flagship event this year, our London conference on November the 19th, will focus on the resurgence of interest amongst the scientific community of viewing and treating cancer in this way. Our keynote speaker will be Travis Christofferson, author of Tripping Over the Truth, A History of Metabolic Theory, who will be coming over from the USA especially for the event. He'll be speaking alongside other UK experts involved in this important field. So over now to Dr. Contreras for his thoughts on cancer as a metabolic disease. Hi, Dr. Contreras.
Robin, it's great to be with you again.
I'm really pleased to get another chance to talk to you here more about your enormous perspective, your lifetime's worth of helping people with cancer. We're here at a talk in London with Sophie Savage, who I understand is one of your patients.
Yes.
Also an awesome author and in her own right on the subject, and both speaking together. I'm really looking forward to a great event. But what I'd like to talk to you about now is I'd like to talk about cancer as a metabolic disease. This is a subject that we're going to be focusing on at the end of this year, building up to November. And it's very familiar territory to you, of course, because the Oasis has been treating people with metabolic treatments for decades. But, you know, right now, after decades of being dismissed by all the genetic theorists, there's a bit of a fresh look is being taken at the metabolic approach. So, to start out, can you tell us in simple terms what metabolic theory says and what genetic theory says, which is the two sides of the coin?
Well, let's start with genetics because it's what it's in now as far as the research in oncology is concerned. And it's very interesting. It's very sexy from the point of view of, you know, publications and coming up with new things. We are finding cancer-specific mutations just about, you know, between 10 and 15 per year. And so the thing is now to do a genetic profile of the tumor, and depending on the mutations, we are now developing specific biological agents to interfere with the production those mutations cause. So the cancer will help itself and protect itself with mutations that will produce certain proteins that are necessary for it to grow and thrive. And medications are being now developed to block the production of those proteins. And thus you can theoretically have a very, very personalized therapy. And it sounds great. And as I tell you, it's very interesting and nice, and everybody wants to get involved. But the problem is that we have, to date, maybe 25 or 30 biologicals or treatments that will block through signaling transduction the production of those proteins. But a breast cancer patient on average has about 25 to 30 mutations. So we don't have enough for one patient. And it can be different with a different patient.
Yeah.
Colon cancer patients may have up to 170 mutations.
Right. Okay.
And each one of those blocking agents, the cost in America is about $10,000 a month. So if you have 10 mutations, imagine the amount of money that you need. So it is very sexy, it is very interesting, but it's really an impractical and impossible therapy to follow. Now, on the biological side, what we've been doing for decades is that we look at the common denominators of the needs of cancer. And one very easy one is the way they produce energy. They're very inefficient in producing energy. And it's a common denominator, whether it's cancer of the breast, cancer of the colon, if it's a sarcoma, or if it's a squamous cell carcinoma. It doesn't matter. They all have this deficiency on how to produce energy, and they need vast amounts of sugar, all of them. So just by reducing the intake of sugar from patients, you can harm cancer. And even though oncologists, you know, frown upon this, we all know that it's true because the basis of a PET CT, which is now the norm in how to diagnose or follow up a patient with cancer.
It's a type of scan.
It's a scan
yeah.
that uses a very special type of radioactive sugar that you inject to the patient, then you scan the patient, and because the tumors need so much sugar, they actually gobble up this sugar and light up. And so it's amazing to me that even though this knowledge has been there, you know, since 1930, we are not exploiting this. I mean, the oncological community. But at the Oasis of Hope, we've known this for many years, and thus diet plays a major role in how to treat cancer. And so biologically, tumors, again, regardless of whether they're from the pancreas or the lung, or any type of cancer, they all have common denominator metabolic activities that we exploit in order to treat them. And these common denominators are about 10.
Right.
They're not that vast. And so by attacking those 10 common denominators, we've had much better results than any other cancer center in the world.
Right, so in summary, you might say that genetic theory focuses on the specifics of a particular cancer in a particular person and develops treatment approaches that are supposed to be that specific. But the metabolic theory, it focuses on the common features of all cancers, and it seeks to interrupt, if you like, it's looking at cancer as a process.
Correct.
And it seeks to interrupt this process.
Yes.
And thereby either halt or even reverse cancer through that. So it seems like both the things, they have some merit in them.
Because, of course.
Because, of course, these specific targets, they're true, aren't they?
No question about it.
And given that at the moment you couldn't say we're really getting on top of cancer, I would say we kind of need all the resources we can get our hands on.
No question about it. We have been combining these therapies now for many years. So if I have a patient with an EGFR mutation, and it's proven, then I can combine our therapies if the tumor is growing too fast.
Right.
With Avastin, for instance, or Erbitux, which are these monoclonal antigens that I mentioned to you that are very specific for this gene mutation with success. The advantage of that is tumor reduction in a shorter time.
Right.
These medications, these new medications have proven to be quite effective, but only for a short time, between 4 and 6 months, and then they don't work anymore. But we can take advantage in those months. Let's say if a patient has a tumor in the bronchi that is not allowing this patient to breathe, and an alternative therapy is going to take 4 or 5 months, the combination may take 4 or 5 weeks or less to reduce that tumor to where the patient can breathe. And then we know that we can treat with our therapy for a very, very long time without any toxicity. So yes, we can take advantage of everything that is out there in order to help a patient.
Hmm. So in a way, these new targeted treatments are similar to chemotherapy in as much as they have a working life, if you like, after which period cancer says, okay, we've worked out what's going on here, but this, we're going to do this to get round the side. They actually become resistant, don't they?
They can. They work in a very different way, the mode of action, but it's a little bit complicated, but you're right. The cancer will then mutate again.
Right.
And then that medication that was very specific for the mutation that's not there again is not going to help that patient.
Right. So, but nonetheless, you know, a chemotherapy can be useful in terms of, like, if you've got a raging fire and you want to just get things under control enough so that you can then, as you say, carry on with some other less toxic treatments, it's got a use.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, a lot of people consider that the Oasis of Hope is an alternative hospital. While we do alternative therapies, we have everything available to our patients at the Oasis. So if a patient would be benefited with chemotherapy, we have it available, or radiation therapy or surgery. So it's not that we think that all of it is wrong, is that relying on those three to help cancer patients is wrong, because there's so many other things that can be helpful.
And they're very often not a long-term solution. Correct. Anyway. So between those two, chemotherapy, the old, if you like, the targeted therapies, the new, is in terms of quality of life, is there a big difference between the two? Are you likely to be much better off having a targeted treatment?
Usually targeted therapies, though they may have some severe side effects, they have a lot less side effects than
right.
the chemotherapy.
Right. Okay, that's important. Okay, so theorists on either side of this great divide between the metabolic and the genetic, they're involved in a disagreement not so much about what's actually occurring in cancer, but more about the sequence of the events, i.e. it's a sort of chicken and egg scenario where both sides are saying, well, no, you guys are just mucking about with something which is a side effect. We're dealing with the cause here.
Correct.
There's
no question that there is a genetic component.
Yes,
absolutely,
exactly,
no question.
There.
I'm not questioning it at all. I'm just saying that it's daunting and impractical to follow that route to really help cancer patients, especially in countries where there's no money.
Right.
Even in the UK, I'm sure that nobody's going to be able to, no government is ever going to be able to pay for 15 or 20 of those agents that are extremely expensive. So, yes, I have no quarrel with the theory. It's there. It's proven. And I'm able to exploit it as much as possible whenever a patient has the sufficient funds to do it. But there are the metabolic component, it's also a fact.
Right.
And it's much easier to approach and less costly. So why shouldn't we do it?
Absolutely. So the fact that there is a kind of disagreement about which of them is a side effect of the other, does that matter?
To the patient, it doesn't.
No.
But unfortunately, I don't know why there is such a resistance from the oncological community to view the metabolic side as helpful to patients. Mm. They don't believe at all that food or diet can have an impact, and that's astounding to me that they don't read the literature, because there's hundreds of papers showing that. Mm. They don't believe that there are certain nutrients that can do exactly the same activity as the monoclonal antigens at a fraction of the cost. And the literature is available to them. It's published in very reputable journals and done by researchers that are very well respected. So it's really amazing to me that no other oncologists or oncological groups are doing what we're doing, because it's all scientifically based.
So this sort of resurgence of interest, though, in metabolics, which it is coming up, and people are beginning to look at this side of things. It's a minority interest for sure. But nonetheless, it's making quite a high-profile comeback. Do you think that's due to the kind of floundering of the genetic path, the fact they're realizing that it's simply unaffordable, and so they better start looking somewhere else?
And they really put their foot on the mouth. It's an American saying. I don't know if, you know, when you say something and it's wrong, and then you have to accept it.
All right.
What has been happening in the community, especially in oncological, is that we say it has to be evidence-based,
yes.
Correct?
Yes. evidence?
Well, the evidence is that this year more people are going to die of cancer than last
That's
year.
Right.
And so the failure is in their faces.
Yeah.
And the younger generation of oncologists is much more open to doing something different because they know that chemo, radiation, surgery, and the new targeted therapies are not really changing the death toll.
Well, that's good. Not before time, eh? Yeah. So you, and before you, your father, you've been offering approaches that target the metabolism cancer at the Oasis for more than 50 years. Could you tell us about some of these aspects that you're targeting exactly and what you're targeting them with, how they work?
Well, one of the major common denominators for cancer patients is a very poor immune system. That's across the board because literally you cannot develop cancer if you have a good immune system.
It is an immune failure, basically.
No question about it. That's why you will find people that smoke all day, that drink all day, that do no exercise, that eat junk, and never develop cancer. They were born and they were gifted with an incredible immune system.
Right.
So you only develop cancer where your immune system fails. And the therapies that we normally give, chemo, radiation, surgery, they're all insults or insulting to the immune system. That's the technical word in medicine. Okay, it's an insult.
Yeah.
So we treat immune deficient patients with immune suppressing therapies. Thus, the poor results. So our main thrust has always been to provide resources to our patients for them to improve their immune system. And there, you know, the theory for many years has been that some immune vaccines could be very, very good. And we have used vaccines, you know, for many, many years. But in 2011, two groups got a Nobel Prize for finding out how really the dendritic cells work. And because of those publications, new technologies were developed to produce a much better kind of dendritic vaccine. So,
since, just be clear on what dendritic cells are exactly.
Dendritic cells are part of the immune system, part of the white cells, and these are the cells that keep the memory of everything that has ever happened to you. So if you had an infection, whether it was viral or bacterial or fungal, there's antigens created, and then they keep the memory so that if you are attacked again, then they know exactly
what
to do.
Yeah, we know this one.
And the dendritic cells don't actually attack anything.
Right.
But they have that memory, and they're called presenter cells. So they actually tell the T cells, which are, let's say, the part of the immune system that have the guns.
Right.
And they point to the guy with the gun, hey, that person or that cell there or that bug is bad. You need to kill it.
Right.
So they're called presenter cells. If there's no presentation, nothing happens. And all cancer patients have a low dendritic count. That's a common denominator. So due to this new technology, our immunologists at the Oasis of Hope have now developed with these new techniques this dendritic cell vaccine. And they have improved our results significantly. So we have been using since about 2013, 2014. We have added to our arsenal the dendritic cell vaccine. So helping the immune system of a patient fight cancer is the most effective way that you can do it. And that's across the board. The other, I mentioned, just to give another example that I mentioned to you, were cell signaling transducting agents. That's the basis for the production of this targeted therapies.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that there are some nutrients that can do exactly the same. For instance, curcumin will do exactly the same thing as Avastin.
Mm.
Avastin is $10,000 a month. Curcumin is about 10 cents.
Yeah.
And the problem with curcumin, and there's a tremendous amount of literature published on that fact, but it's very poorly absorbed. So in order to get the levels into the bloodstream to actually do what Avastin does is very difficult orally. So thank God we were approved about 3 months ago for an injectable curcumin at the Oasis of Hope.
Okay.
So now we have that available. And again, we have now preliminary results on about 15 patients with incredible results. Patients that failed to everything, including our therapy. And now we're bringing them back, and today I will be showing a couple of cases
with
that.
Very interesting.
So we are
just a question on the curcumin. Is this a liposomal curcumin? Is it?
Or yes.
Yes, it is.
It is. Right. But we were able to have it now injectable.
Right.
And the other thing is that not only are we using curcumin and producing it in a soluble solution, we are using nanoparticles
right.
of curcumin, because then the absorption is going to be much greater and the surface area increases immensely.
Right.
So these techniques are, we're definitely innovating as far as the application is concerned. But the science behind it has been there for a long, long time, and the results in animals are astounding.
Mm.
But because it's a food and you can't patent it, nobody is going to do research on it. But we're very happy that that we have it now available and are using it on patients.
Mm. Sounds brilliant. Okay, and any other kind of biological interrupters, if you like, of cancer processes that
well,
you regularly use?
If you want to talk about biologicals, the vaccines are all biological.
Yes.
And they're autologous. That is, we prepare these vaccines from the patient's blood and, when possible, the patient's tumors.
Mm.
And the other ones are basically nutritional in effect, but they have the same mode of action as the biologicals for targeted therapies.
Right.
So we're very excited. We're very hopeful for the future of cancer patients.
Mm. Developments. One of the methods that's receiving a deal of attention from the metabolics camp is the ketogenic diet. Now, I believe you're less enthusiastic than they are, but could you tell us briefly about, well, what the diet is and what the thinking behind it is, and then maybe tell us your view on it?
I became very interested and still am interested in the ketogenic diet because theoretically it makes so much sense.
Okay, so maybe and, just give us a light version of the theory.
Yes. the way that it works is that it provides no carbohydrates for the malignant cell. And when the malignant cell has no carbohydrates, it has to go into the mode of producing energy through the burning of protein and fat. And if you provide no carbohydrates and no protein and only fat, the ketogenic diet is a diet based on fats, good fats. Then the production of energy is going to leave waste material that are ketones, I think in English.
Ketones. Yeah.
And ketones are very nauseous to cancer.
Right.
So they actually can kill the cancer. So I developed a research program based on this, combining the fact that on a ketogenic diet, you also have to have a very low calorie count. So the sweet spot for the ketogenic diet to work is a very low glycemic index and a high ketogenic index. It's very difficult to achieve. So in our project, we had our patients actually fast for 21 days with a very low intake of fats in order to get that sweet spot proven by laboratory test. In some cases, the patients had to be sedated. After a few days, they were going crazy with only 200 or 300 calories of intake.
Hmm.
But laboratory-wise, we were getting that sweet spot, right on the dot, according to the literature.
Mm.
The results were very poor. Mm. And it's just so difficult for the patient to be able to do that.
So what results were you looking for?
Well, I was looking for tumor reduction.
Yes.
And did not get it.
No, right.
And so after 21 days, it's as far as cancer is concerned, it's a very short time, but for the patient is a tremendously
yeah.
long time. And so if in 21 days we saw virtually nothing, I didn't expect it in 50 days to see more. And you cannot have a patient on that sweet spot for
right.
such a long time.
Right.
So just doing it on their own, it doesn't work.
Right. So was that a range of different cancers?
Yes, we had, although I tried to keep it, most of the patients were breast cancer patients. We had a few with colon cancer and a few with lung cancer. Mm-hmm. There were 40 patients or 38 patients thereabouts in the study. And again, I strongly believe that the theory is right, but you know, so many times from the theory to the practical application, there's a big gap. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not practical. It's just very, very difficult for a patient to do that.
Mm-hmm. So do you think it's going to prove to have any role at all?
The fact that in order for it to work, you have to have that sweet spot, a very low glycemic index with very high ketonic index, I really don't see how.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So another area that's generating a great deal of excitement is the potential for cheap, safe, old, out-of-patent drugs to affect metabolic pathways. This is something that's been noted for many years, but nobody's taken any interest in
it
because there's no money. But actually, a lot of people have started to take interest in it recently. So do you think that the hype about this is justified, and do you use any?
No question. For instance, we've been using metformin now for 10 years.
Right.
And there's a tremendous amount of information scientifically that patients with cancer that take metformin will have much longer periods of remission, and they live longer than the patients that don't take it.
They found this out just because diabetics did much better on if they got
Right. Yeah. And there are studies now that have proven that the reason why metformin works, we thought at first that the reason was low glycemic index. Mm. But that is really secondary. What they found is that metformin actually kills stem cells from cancer, which chemotherapy does not kill. In fact, vitamin C doesn't kill it. And because those stem cells are left behind, the incidence of recurrence is so high. So if we address that, then the incidence of recurrence will be less and the patients will live longer. And metformin is dirt cheap.
Yeah.
But there are other drugs that are not very cheap that are also very important. For instance, a COX-2 inhibiting agent like Celebrex has proven to be very effective in reducing tumor activity, especially of the colon, but in many other cancers. So we use Celebrex as well. We use a very, very low amount of a steroid because NF-kappa-B can be blocked by a number of nutrients, but the only drug that really brings that count down is a steroid. So in a minute amount in which we give it to our patients, they can take it for a long time with no side effects whatsoever. Mm. Another one is Pepcid. You know, this drug that you use for gastritis is very effective because it does not allow malignant cells to conglomerate, to aggregate. And so it works like aspirin for red blood cells. Mm-hmm. It does the same thing for malignant cells possibility for metastasis drops significantly. Yeah. So there's a number of drugs that you can use off-label. Off-label means that you can use them for what they were not approved, but that science has shown it to be useful for. Omeprazole is another one. Omeprazole has been proven to actually interfere or change the pH of the actual tumor environment. So you can rise the level of the pH with omeprazole. And if you alkalinize a tumor, it can't survive.
So this has long been one of the targets of dietary approaches.
Exactly. But dietary things rarely affect the pH of the tumor at all. So there's only two things that have been proven to affect the pH of the tumor environment. Omeprazole and baking soda.
Right.
This is much cheaper. So we use baking soda in all of our patients.
Do you use in what form do you use it?
Orally. You know, this there's a researcher in Italy, and based on his studies, I was doing IV and intratumoral. But then the Americans published about 7 years ago a very well done study on baking soda. And so they had four groups of animals, the control, IV, intratumoral, and oral. And the best results long term were with oral, much cheaper. So I stopped the IV and the intratumoral because we're getting very good results just with oral intake of baking soda or sodium bicarbonate.
Yes. So these drugs, if they actually did make their way back into the mainstream for these kind of uses, could have a massive effect actually on the outcomes.
Yes.
You know, in combination with all the regulatory.
Yes, I'm really surprised that the industry, the pharmaceutical industry, hasn't promoted this. And I think the reason for that is that if you have, let's say, a drug, metformin, approved for diabetes, you have to go through the whole process of registration to get it approved for a different indication. Mm. That's very costly. And I think that when they make their analysis, is not worth it for them. I don't know why, but it should.
But that's because it's essentially it's the same molecule, so they can't. It's not a new patent, so therefore they
exactly
they haven't
with
got
the same
on
right.
Right, so it's not worth investing in. Yeah, so I've heard of people actually making some sort of minute changes in order to make something into a new.
And then make it very expensive. I think they should because then you know at least medical doctors that don't believe in any alternatives would at least have more tools to help patients.
It's true, but on the other hand, of course, I mean the drugs are there and they're available cheaply, but they're not being used, and they won't be used as long as the ear of the medics is taken up completely with the sales arm of pharmaceuticals.
That's true, and that is unfortunate.
It's very unfortunate, but I mean, to me, this is where governments should intervene, because governments aren't... I mean, pharmaceuticals are interested in making money. Let's face it, that's all they care about, really.
Well, even if they care about everything else, they need to make money.
But governments are supposed to be looking after their people, so they could actually... either needed to be research or trials to give the go-ahead for metformin for a different application, should be government-funded if it's not profitable.
Now, that is a very interesting position. I think you're right. I never thought about it that way. But the government could say, you know, we just approve it for that without taxing the industry to produce more evidence, because the evidence is already there.
And they're safe. As well, all the safety studies.
They're very, very well known drugs.
Yeah, and so for low cost, low side effects, you know, you could have a massive leap, a step change in cancer treatment.
Yes.
Yeah.
You should run for office. That's a very good idea.
Thank you. I'll hold on that one for now. Okay, so maybe you could just sort of summarize now what you think a renewal of interest by the scientific community in the metabolics of cancer, what effect that could have on cancer treatment as a whole, where we could be based on your own experience, where you're embracing the whole world of pharmaceuticals and the technical side of medicine, of orthodox medicine, and you're adding to it with other things. So you've got a good eye on what the potential is there for combining these things. Orthodox medicine could be doing the same thing. What difference would this make?
It would make an enormous difference. Just the fact that Orthodox doctors would have more tools to help the patients, that would be wonderful. I'm very hopeful because I'm seeing a tremendous change in the young generation of oncologists in regards to my generation that are very square and they don't believe that it should change. And they want to continue allowing patients to die. So the younger generation is really open because of the failure is in their faces. And so I think that in the very near future, many of the things that we've been doing for many years that are completely scientifically based are going to be looked upon with better eyes from this younger generation, and I think that's going to impact in a very positive way the cancer community of the world.
So there's a lot of avenues this can take. I mean, we already talked about the repurposed drugs. That's one arm, if you like. There's the whole dietary arm, which is completely missing at the moment. In fact, completely denied. There's the immune stimulatory route, which you've spoken about. There are attempts at drugs to do this, but I understand.
Oh, again, there's a tremendous expensive. There's tremendous interest. Our protocol is based on all research done in the United States of America. The problem is in developed countries, even these processes have to go through the FDA. Mexico was very clever in saying, as long as the vaccines are produced from the same patient, as long as they're autologous,
right,
you don't have to go through the whole process because all of the science is there. And that's why we can do them in Mexico. Whereas in America, no. They have to do the same process, and that's why it's going to be terribly expensive. Right. It's already expensive to produce them, but at least Mexico is saying, you know, what harm could it be if you are producing from the patient's blood an element that you're going to give back to the patient? Where is the risk?
Right.
Logically, there's an extremely low risk.
That's a bit of common sense.
If there are other vaccines that you use from other people.
Right.
Now, those have to, in Mexico, they have to go through the process because you have to prove the safety. But as long as they're coming from the same patient, where's the risk?
Well, that's very heartening. And common sense is something that's often
very
missing.
Uncommon.
Uncommon, unfortunately. But that's great. It's very pragmatic. And equally, I think Mexico is much more open to accepting the evidence from other parts of the world and
definitely
not needing to have their own. In Britain, it's like, well, okay, they proved it in China, but that doesn't mean it's proved. We have to do it ourselves.
Correct. They don't believe.
They don't believe. So, but Mexico is much more open to.
Yes. Obviously, that if something is approved in China, it's not as open.
Right.
But anything that's approved in the EU or in the US.
Okay. Straight through.
I mean, yeah. that's the highest bar. So, yes, in that sense, Mexico is very open.
Well, it's lucky that one country is, because it's making some things possible.
Really, and everything has to do with politics.
Yeah.
Why our people are poor. Why make our people spend the money when it's already been done?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the guests I had on my show was one of the foremost practitioners in the whole area of photodynamic therapy. And, you know, so much of the work has gone on in the UK. They've got fantastic technicians, developed amazing things. And in this country, it's just like completely ignored. The funding's been pulled on it. This chap is actually, he's a megastar in countries where they got no money, because he can get out there, he can give them all the equipment they need to set up a clinic for £5,000, and each treatment costs £200 or £300. And this is a proven treatment with very low side effects, almost none, can be repeated as necessary. And we don't get it because it's not expensive enough for us here. That's the truth.
Yes.
Anyway, I think that's about it for today.
Well,
thank you so much for coming on the show again. Really, always good to talk to you. And I think I'm pretty sure that our listeners are really feel they benefited from what you shared today.
Well, thank you very much, Robert.
One of the things that's very apparent from hearing Dr. Contreras is their attitude at the Oasis of Hope towards choice of treatments. All approaches are considered valid in the appropriate circumstances. This is the power of integrative medicine. Nothing is excluded for philosophical reasons. Every approach is a candidate for consideration based on experience of its ability to help. Science provides direction, but clinical experience ultimately guides choices. Driving practice forwards is a spirit of open-minded investigation, a continual quest to improve results and to give better care to patients. To me, this is entirely the appropriate stance for a cancer hospital, and one that is echoed by many other world-leading cancer clinics. One of the results of such an approach is a divergence of views on particular methods. As you've heard, Dr. Contreras has not found the ketogenic diet to be helpful in his experience, which is in strong contrast with others who have been my guests. So there's a lot to be learned from investigating these divergent views to find out the source of the discrepancies. I shall look to give this more attention in future shows. If you're interested to find out more about cancer as a metabolic disease, then I thoroughly recommend reading Tripping Over the Truth by Travis Christofferson, which I mentioned in the introduction. As well, of course, as attending our London conference, Cancer as a Metabolic Disease, on November the 19th. The event I attended at which I interviewed Dr. Contreras was as brilliant as I anticipated, and I'm pleased to say it was videotaped, so hopefully the talks will be available on the internet shortly for those who missed it, or indeed for those who'd like to hear the excellent talks again. If you're interested to hear more from Dr. Contreras, then do go to the Listen on Demand section of the Yes to Life show, and if you look back over past shows, you'll find two other interviews with him. A reminder that our new book, The Cancer Revolution, is available from bookshops and on Amazon, as well as from thecancerrevolution.co.uk. And if you want to find out more about the book before buying, then that's also the website to look at. Lastly, but very importantly, Yes to Life has an event later this week in the Lifestyle Choices and Cancer series. It's being held in East London on Saturday, the 2nd of July, and it features top nutritionist and previous guest on this show, Liz Butler, who will be talking about the value of testing, as well as biologist and mycotherapist Catalina Fernandez de Ana Portela, who has been working closely with oncologists in Spain, running clinical trials of an integrative approach to several types of cancer. This seminar will be of great interest to both practitioners and people with cancer. To find out more and to book, go to the Yes to Life website, yestolife.org.uk, click Events in the left-hand sidebar, and then choose Seminars. That's all for today's show. Please follow Yes to Life and me, Robin Daly, on Facebook and Twitter, and do join me again next week for another exploration of integrative medicine for cancer. Goodbye.